We're talking about renunciation in this hour, thinking about what a powerful force it can be in people's lives, for better and for worse. And giving something up, whether it's a glass of wine or a way of life, can be really hard and painful, and it can change people in ways they don't expect. This is Howard Axelrod's story.
It was 2 weeks before the end of my junior year. I went to play some pickup basketball. I had played high school basketball, and I loved going to the court to play just as a way to relax. And there was just a freak accident. A boy's finger went into my eye, and it severed the optic nerve, which is the cable that connects the back of the eye to the brain. So I was blinded in my right eye.
Howard Axelrod was a student at Harvard when that happened. It seemed like he had everything going for him, and then suddenly he was blind in one eye. He had trouble seeing, no peripheral vision, no depth perception. He felt permanently disoriented and vulnerable and depressed. And after a while, he decided he would just leave his old life behind. So he went to Vermont. He found a tiny, remote cabin, pretty close to being off the grid, and he stayed there, alone, for 2 years. He wrote a beautiful memoir about it called The Point of Vanishing. Steve Paulson asked him to describe the place.
So the cabin was pretty ramshackle. It did have a wood stove for heat. In the morning when I would wake up, and I'm remembering winter now because it seemed like it was always winter. And when I would wake up, I could see my breath because the fire would have burnt down. So I would get the wood stove going again. And mostly what I did was just go for walks. I mean, outwardly, it looked like I probably wasn't doing all that much. But what I was doing on my walks was actually, to me, was pretty important. I was seeing more. I felt more at ease. I began to feel less like an intrusion on the landscape and more just like I was part of the woods.
And just to put this in perspective, I mean, you were really isolated at this point. I mean, yes, you had your landline, but no cell phone, no computer, no TV. You went days at a time without seeing anyone, without talking to anyone. I mean, did it actually start to get hard to interact with other people?
It did. You forget how much you're filtering out on a daily basis when you walk down the street in a city. Your senses, you know, to pay attention to the person you're talking to or even to whatever you're focusing on, there's so much you're blocking out. And in the woods, the filters on my senses just dropped because there's nothing you don't want to see and there's nothing you don't want to hear. So then when I would go into the small town, miles, maybe a 15-minute drive from where I lived, I would be overwhelmed. I mean, this was just a 8-aisle market, but they would sometimes be playing on their overhead speakers, the local pop radio station, and to hear Elton John, you know, or Whitney Houston, which it seems is just sort of always what they're playing in supermarkets, incidentally, would be overwhelming. I couldn't, because I hadn't been listening to any music. I hadn't been listening to anything really other than the snow falling or occasionally a bird. And I had a hard time just navigating a small town market.
Well, I got the sense that your parents started getting kind of worried about you, and you write about this time when you'd been living in the woods for over a year, and they convinced you to come down to see them for Thanksgiving. And so you went to see them, and there were a whole pile of relatives there, and it turned into kind of a disaster, didn't it, that visit at Thanksgiving?
It did. You know, it's one thing to be overwhelmed in a supermarket by Elton John's Rocket Man. It's another thing entirely to have to see your whole family in the suburbs of New York City. And it was very hard for me. And then maybe part of what you're referring to is the morning after that Thanksgiving, I had slept in my aunt and uncle's backyard in a tent just to give myself a little more room. And I went for a walk in their neighborhood and policemen stopped me, two cop cars. Because apparently I was such a threat. And what they said was that a neighbor had been looking out her window and had seen a strange man. I mean, at this point, I had a long, bushy beard. And I also realized once they stopped me that I was just wearing long johns for pants. I didn't even have pants on. So, yeah,
had kind of forgotten how to function in regular society.
A number of things had slipped, so to speak. I was really telling what they said was this woman looked out her window and saw a strange man. I said yes, and they said what was so strange was that she said you were just walking very slowly and looking at things. And that, I don't know, that seems so odd to me that that would be such an aberration that for someone to be walking slowly and looking is a cause for suspicion. Now, of course, I was probably also a cause for suspicion because of my bushy beard and because I wasn't wearing pants. But I guess the combination.
Once you visited your relatives at Thanksgiving, you went back to Vermont, winter came again, and you write about one night where you probably came pretty close to dying, collapsed in the snow, even fell asleep out there. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, so I every once in a while I would get a really bad headache behind my right eye, and I was in a lot of pain, so I went outside into the snow just to lie in the snow. I don't know, I guess it was my version of Tylenol. And I fell asleep in the snow. I mean, I don't quite know how that happened, but I did. And I fell asleep, and I had this very disturbing dream about being back in my high school and knowing that I had killed somebody. And I couldn't remember who I had killed. I only knew that the body was hidden somewhere, and I had to make sure it stayed hidden. And so I searched through my high school and then found in this locker. I knew the body was in a locker, and I finally found the locker, and I opened the locker, and what I saw was my own corpse. So it was. So and then I woke
talk,
up.
Talk about symbolism.
Talk about symbolism. Yeah, I mean, it's funny. It's as though my subconscious was saying to me, "Listen, we're going to break it down for you really slowly, and we're going to make it really obvious because we don't want you to miss this. We think you're not paying attention to what you should be paying attention to. We're going to make it as clear as we can." And also then I woke up, and of course I'd fallen asleep in the snow. So now I was extremely, I mean, more than cold. I mean, I was, my teeth were chattering, and my feet were numb, and my hands were numb. And I had just seen this vision of myself as a corpse, you know, with my face all white. And I finally got the picture.
Yeah. You have a passage, a beautiful passage where you write about sort of the outcome of that evening. I mean, you sort of were desperately trying to warm up again. But I'm wondering if you could read a bit from your book.
Sure. The shaking slowed down, and I felt impossibly lighter, fatigued, almost nothing but bones. I stood up in the shower, made the water hotter. Feeling was coming back in my feet, in my hands. My blood was running like it hadn't for a long time. Later, after I dressed in my warmest clothes, I carried the wool blanket from the bed downstairs and lay down in front of the fire. By morning, it had burned down to embers, just a few glowing coals hidden under ash. But I was still there, with the morning light on the floorboards, the snow falling outside. And I felt something I hadn't felt for a long time, a desire for the future, a feeling that good days might be ahead, days with other people, days to look forward to, days I might allow myself to trust.
Hmm. So this whole experience happened about 15 years ago, and I mean, obviously you've been spending a lot of time thinking about it as you wrote the memoir, but is it still with you in some way? I mean, is the person that you are today to some degree shaped by those 2 years of isolation in the woods?
Very much so. I mean, still every morning, just this morning too, I go for a walk, and I'm not miles from the nearest person. I'm not wearing snowshoes, but I'm still going for a walk, and I'm still walking just to see what I see, to look at the trees in the park near my house, and to try to let my mind go quiet. And then when I sit down at my desk to write, I hope to be listening. Sometimes when I'm writing, it feels a little bit like teaching, and how there's always a student in the front row waving his hands, ready to have the answer to every question. And you have to call on them sometimes, but you're really waiting for that quiet kid in the back who rarely says anything, who suddenly raises her hand and then says something true. When I'm sitting at my desk, I'm trying to wait for that one quiet, true thing that person in the back, or that thought all the way in the back of my mind, has just offered. So I do think that's all in some ways a result of the time I spent in the woods. I hope that when I'm listening to other people, that I listen in a way that maybe I wasn't capable of before. So yes, I think it's all stayed with me, although I now do remember to wear pants if I go for a walk. And I hope I'm not frightening neighbors and school children anymore.
Howard Axelrod's memoir of his 2 years in solitude is called The Point of Vanishing. Steve Paulson talked with him.